From the studios of Books in Motion in Spokane, Washington, this is Cameron Byerly reading Book 3 of the Belgariad, Magician's Gambit, by David Eddings. We begin with the prologue. Being an account of how Gorham sought a god for his people, and of how he found Ul upon the sacred mountain of Prolgu, based upon the Book of Ulgo and other fragments. At the beginning of days, the world was spun out of darkness by the seven gods, and they also created beasts and fowls, serpents and fishes, and lastly, man. Now there dwelt in the heavens a spirit known as Ul, who did not join in this creation. And because he withheld his power and wisdom, much that was made was marred and imperfect. Many creatures were unseemly and strange. These the younger gods sought to unmake, so that all upon the world might be fair. But Ul stretched forth his hand and prevented them, saying, "What you have wrought, you may not unmake. You have torn asunder the fabric and peace of the heavens to bring forth this world as a plaything and an entertainment. Know, however, that whatsoever you make, be it ever so monstrous, shall abide as a rebuke for your folly. In the day that one thing which you have made is unmade, all shall be unmade." The younger gods were angered. To each monstrous or unseemly thing that they had made, they said, "Go thou to Ul, and let him be thy god." Then from the races of men, each god chose that people which pleased him. And when there were yet peoples who had no god, the younger gods drove them forth and said, "Go unto Ul, and he shall be your god." And Ul did not speak. For long and bitter generations, the godless ones wandered and cried out unheard in the wastelands and wilderness of the west. Then there appeared among their numbers a just and righteous man named Gorim. He gathered the multitudes before him and spoke to them. "We wither and fall as the leaves from the rigors of our wanderings. Our children and our old men die. Better it is that only one shall die. Therefore stay here and rest upon this plain. I will search for the god named Ul, so that we may worship him and have a place in this world." For 20 years Gorim sought Ul, but in vain. Yet the years passed. His hair turned gray, and he wearied of his search. In despair he went up onto a high mountain and cried in a great voice to the sky, "No more! I will search no longer. The gods are a mockery and deception, and the world is a barren void. There is no Ul, and I am sick of the curse and affliction of my life." The spirit of Ul heard and replied, "Why art thou wroth with me, Gorim? Thy making and thy casting out were none of my doing." Gorim was afraid and fell upon his face, and Ul spoke again, saying, "Rise, Gorim, for I am not thy god." Gorim did not arise. "Oh, my God," he cried, "hide not thy face from thy people, who are sorely afflicted because they are outcast and have no god to protect them." "Rise, Gorim," Ul repeated, "and quit this place. Cease thy complaining. Seek thou a god elsewhere, and leave me in peace." Still, Gorim did not rise.
"Oh, my God, I will still abide. Thy people hunger and thirst. They seek thy blessing and a place where they may dwell."
"Thy speech wearies me," Ul said, and he departed. Gorim remained on the mountain, and the beasts of the field and the fowls of the air brought him sustenance. For more than a year he remained. Then the monstrous and unseemly things which the gods had made came and sat at his feet, watching him. The spirit of Ul was troubled. At last he appeared to Gorham. "Abidest thou still?" Gorham fell on his face and said,
"O my God, thy people cry unto thee in their affliction."
The spirit of Ul fled. But Gorham abode there for another year. Dragons brought him meat, and unicorns gave him water. And again Ul came to him asking, "Abidest thou even still?" Gorham fell on his face.
"O my God, thy people perish in the absence of thy care."
And Ul fled from the righteous man. Another year passed, while nameless, unseen things brought him food and drink. And the spirit of Ul came to the high mountain and ordered, "Rise, Gorham." From his prostrate position, Gorham pleaded,
"O my God, have mercy."
"Rise, Gorham," Ul replied. He reached down and lifted Gorham up with his hands. "I am Ul, thy God. I command thee to rise and stand before me."
"Then wilt thou be my God, and God unto my people?"
"I am thy God, and the God of thy people also." Gorham looked down from his high place and beheld the unseemly creatures which had cared for him in his travail.
"And what of these, O my God? Wilt thou be God unto the basilisk, and the minotaur, the dragon, and the chimera, the unicorn and the things unnamed, the winged serpent and the thing unseen? For these are also outcast. Yet there is beauty in each. Turn not your face from them, my God. For in them is great worthiness. They were sent to thee by the younger gods. Who will be their God if you refuse them?"
"It was done in my despite. These creatures were sent unto me to bring shame upon me, that I had rebuked the younger gods. I will in no wise be God unto monsters." The creatures at Gorham's feet moaned. Gorham seated himself on the earth and said,
"Yet will I abide, O my God."
"Abide if it please thee," Ul said, and departed. It was even as before. Gorham abode, the creatures sustained him, and Ul was troubled. And before the holiness of Gorham, the great God repented and came again. "Rise, Gorham, and serve thy God." Ul reached down and lifted Gorham. "Bring unto me the creatures who sit before thee, and I will consider them. If each hath beauty and worthiness, as thou sayest, then will I consent to be their God also." Then Gorham brought the creatures before Ul. The creatures prostrated themselves before the God and moaned to beseech his blessing. Ul marveled that he had not seen the beauty of each creature before. He raised up his hands and blessed them, saying, "I am Ul, and I find beauty and worthiness in each of you. I will be your God, and you shall prosper, and peace shall be among you." Gorham was glad of heart, and he named that high place where all had come to pass Prolgu, which means holy place. Then he departed and returned to the plain to bring his people unto their God. But they did not know him, for the hands of Ul had touched him, and all color had fled, leaving his body and hair as white as new snow. The people feared him and drove him away with stones. Gorham cried unto Ul,
"O my God, thy touch has changed me, and my people know me not."
Ul raised his hand, and the people were made colorless, like Gorham. The spirit of Ul spoke to them in a great voice, "Hearken unto the words of your God. This is he whom you call Gorham, and he has prevailed upon me to accept you as my people, to watch over you, provide for you, and be God over you. Henceforth shall you be called Ulgo, in remembrance of me, and in token of his holiness. You shall do as he commands, and go where he leads. Any who fail to obey him, or follow him, will I cut off to wither and perish and be no more. Gorim commanded the people to take up their goods, and their cattle, and follow him to the mountains. But the elders of the people did not believe him, nor that the voice had been the voice of Ul. They spoke to Gorim in despite, saying, If you are the servant of the god Ul, perform a wonder and proof of it. Gorim answered, Behold, your skin and hair, is that not wonder enough for you? They were troubled and went away. But they came to him again, saying, The mark is upon us because of a pestilence which you brought from some unclean place, and no proof of the favor of Ul. Gorim raised his hands, and the creatures which had sustained him came to him like lambs to a shepherd. The elders were afraid and went away for a time. But soon they came again, saying, The creatures are monstrous and unseemly. You are a demon sent to lure the people to destruction, not a servant of the great god Ul. We still have seen no proof of the favor of Ul. Now Gorim grew weary of them. He cried in a great voice, I say to the people that they have heard the voice of Ul. I have suffered much in your behalf. Now I return to Progru, the holy place. Let him who would follow me do so. Let him who would not remain. He turned and went toward the mountains. Some few people went with him, but the greater part of the people remained, and they reviled Gorim and those who followed him. Where is this wonder which proves the favor of Ul? We do not follow or obey Gorim, yet neither do we wither and perish. Then Gorim looked upon them in great sadness, and spoke to them for the last time. You have besought a wonder from me. Then behold this wonder. Even as the voice of Ul said, you are withered like the limb of a tree that is cut off. Truly, this day you have perished. And he led the few who followed him into the mountains and to Prolgu. The multitude of the people mocked him and returned to their tents to laugh at the folly of those who followed him. For a year they laughed and mocked. Then they laughed no more. For their women were barren and bore no children. The people withered, and in time they perished and were no more. The people who followed Gorim came with him to Prolgu. There they built a city. The spirit of Ul was with them, and they dwelt in peace with the creatures who had sustained Gorim. Gorim lived for many lifetimes, and after him, each high priest of Ul was named Gorim, and lived to a great age. For 2,000 years, the peace of Ul was with them, and they believed it would last forever. But the evil god Torak stole the orb that was made by the god Aldur, and the war of men and gods began. Torak used the orb to break the earth asunder and let in the sea, and the orb burned him horribly, and he fled into Meloria. The earth was maddened by her wounding, and the creatures which had dwelt in peace with the people of Ulgo were also maddened by that wounding. They rose against the fellowship of Ul, and cast down the cities and slew the people, until few remained. Those who escaped fled to Prolgu, where the creatures dared not follow for fear of the wrath of Ul. Loud were the cries and lamentations of the people. Ul was troubled, and he revealed to them the caves that lay under Prolgu. The people went down into the sacred caves of Ul and dwelt there. In time, Belgarath, the sorcerer, led the kings of the Alorns and his sons into Meloria to steal back the orb. When Torak sought to pursue, the wrath of the orb drove him back. Belgarath gave the orb to the first Raven King, saying that so long as one of his descendants held the orb, the West would be safe. Now the Elorn scattered and pushed southward into new lands. And the peoples of other gods were troubled by the war of gods and men, and fled to seize other lands which they called by strange names. But the people of Ul held to the caverns of Prolgu, and had no dealings with them. Ul protected them and hid them, and the strangers did not know that the people were there. For century after century, the people of Ul took no note of the outer world, even when that world was rocked by the assassination of the last Riven king and his family. But when Torak came ravening into the west, leading a mighty army through the lands of the children of Ul, the spirit of Ul spoke with the Gurim, and the Gurim led forth his people in stealth by night. They fell upon the sleeping army and wreaked mighty havoc. Thus the army of Torak was weakened and fell in defeat before the armies of the west, at a place called Vomimbre. Then the Gurim girded himself and went forth to hold counsel with the victors. And he brought back word that Torak had been gravely wounded. Though the evil god's body was stolen away and hidden by his disciple, Belzedar, it was said that Torak would lie bound in sleep like death itself, until a descendant of the Riven line should again sit upon the throne at Riva. Which meant never, since it was known that no descendants of that line lived. Shocking as the visit of the Gurim to the outer world had been, no harm seemed to come of it. The children of Ul still prospered under the care of their god, and life went on almost as before. It was noticed that the Gurim seemed to spend less time studying the Book of Ulgo, and more searching through moldy old scrolls of prophecy. But a certain oddity might be expected of one who had gone forth from the caverns of Ul into the world of other peoples. Then a strange old man appeared before the entrance to the caverns, demanding to speak with the Gurim, and such was the power of his voice that the Gurim was summoned. Then, for the first time since the people had sought safety in the caverns, one who was not of the people of Ul was admitted. The Gurim took the stranger into his chambers, and remained closeted with him for days. And thereafter, the strange man with the white beard and tattered clothing appeared at long intervals, and was welcomed by the Gurim. It was even reported once by a young boy that there was a great gray wolf with the Gurim. But that was probably only some dream, brought on by sickness, though the boy refused to recant. The people adjusted and accepted the strangeness of their Gurim. And the years passed, and the people gave thanks to their god, knowing that they were the chosen people of the great god Ul. Part 1. Maragor. Chapter 1. Her Imperial Highness, Princess Tenedra, jewel of the House of Borun, and the loveliest flower of the Tolnedran Empire, sat cross-legged on a sea-chest in the oak-beamed cabin beneath the stern of Captain Greldick's ship, nibbling thoughtfully on the end of a tendril of her coppery hair, as she watched the Lady Palgara attend to the broken arm of Belgarath, the sorcerer. The princess wore a short, pale-green dryad tunic, and there was a smudge of ash on one of her cheeks. On the deck above, she could hear the measured beat of the drum that paced the oar-strokes of Greldick's sailors as they rowed upstream from the ash-choked city of Stithis Tor. It was all absolutely dreadful, she decided. What had begun as merely another move in the interminable game of authority and rebellion against it that she had been playing with her father, the Emperor, for as long as she could remember, had suddenly turned deadly serious. She had never really intended for things to go this far when she and Master Jeebers had crept from the Imperial Palace in Tolhanath that night so many weeks ago. Jeebers had soon deserted her. He had been no more than a temporary convenience anyway. And now she was caught up with this strange group of grim-faced people from the north in a quest she could not even understand. The Lady Palgara, whose very name sent a chill through the princess, had rather bluntly informed her in the Wood of the Dryads that the game was over and that no evasion, wheedling, or coaxing would alter the fact that she, Princess Zenedra, would stand in the Hall of the Raven King on her 16th birthday, in chains, if necessary. Zenedra knew with absolute certainty that Lady Palgara had meant exactly that, and she had a momentary vision of being dragged, clanking and rattling in her chains, to stand in the total humiliation in that grim hall where hundreds of bearded Aelorns laughed at her. That had to be avoided at any cost. And so it had been that she had been accompanying them, not willingly, perhaps, but never openly rebellious. The hint of steel in Lady Palgara's eyes always seemed to carry with it the suggestion of manacles and clinking chains, and that suggestion cowed the princess into obedience far more than the imperial power her father possessed had ever been able to do. Zenedra had only the faintest idea of what these people were doing. They seemed to be following someone or something, and the trail had led them here, into the snake-infested swamps of Nyssa. Murgos seemed to be somehow involved, throwing frightful obstacles in their path, and Queen Salmisra also seemed to take an interest, even going so far as to have young Geryon abducted. Zenedra interrupted her musing to look across the cabin at the boy. Why would the Queen of Nyssa want him? He was so ordinary. He was a peasant, a scullion, a nobody. He was a nice enough boy, certainly, with rather plain sandy hair that kept tumbling down across his forehead, making her fingers itch to push it back. He had a nice enough face, in a plain sort of way. And he was somebody she could talk to when she was lonely or frightened, and somebody she could fight with when she felt peevish, since he was only slightly older than she was. But he completely refused to treat her with the respect due her. He probably didn't even know how. Why all this excruciating interest in him? She pondered that, looking thoughtfully at him. She was doing it again. Angrily, she jerked her eyes from his face. Why was she always watching him? Each time her thoughts wandered, her eyes automatically sought out his face, and it wasn't really that exciting a face to look at. She had even caught herself making up excuses to put herself into places where she could watch him. It was stupid. Zenedra nibbled at her hair and thought and nibbled some more, until once again her eyes went back to their minute study of Geryon's features.
"Is he going to be all right?"
Barak, the Earl of Trelheim, rumbled, tugging absently at his great red beard as he watched the Lady Palgara putting the finishing touches on Belgareth's sling. "It is a simple break," she replied professionally, putting away her bandages. "And the old fool heals fast." Belgareth winced as he shifted his newly splinted arm.
"You didn't have to be so rough, Paul."
His rust-colored old tunic showed several dark mud smears and a new rip, evidence of his encounter with the tree.
"It had to be set, Father. You did not want to heal crooked, did you?"
"I think you actually enjoyed it," he accused.
"Next time you can set it yourself," she suggested coolly, smoothing her gray dress.
"I need a drink," Belgareth grumbled to the hulking Barak.
The Earl of Trelheim went to the narrow door.
"Would you have a tankard of ale brought for Belgareth?"
he asked the sailor outside.
"How is he?"
the sailor inquired.
"Bad-tempered, and he'll probably get worse if he doesn't get a drink pretty soon."
"I'll go at once," the sailor said.
Wise decision."
This was yet another confusing thing for Zenedra. The noblemen in their party all treated this shabby-looking old man with enormous respect. But so far as she could tell, he didn't even have a title. She could determine with exquisite precision the exact difference between a baron and a general of the Imperial Legions, between a Grand Duke of Tolnedra and a Crown Prince of Orindia, between the Riven Warder and the King of the Cheriks. But she had not the faintest idea where sorcerers fit in.
The materially oriented mind of Tonedra refused even to admit that sorcerers existed. While it was quite true that Lady Polgara, with titles from half of the kingdoms of the West, was the most respected woman in the world, Belgarath was a vagabond, a vagrant, quite frequently a public nuisance, and Geryon, she reminded herself, was his grandson. "I think it's time you told us what happened, Father," Lady Polgara was saying to her patient.
"I'd really rather not talk about it," he replied shortly.
She turned to Prince Keldar, the peculiar little Drasnian nobleman with the sharp face and sardonic wit, who lounged on a bench with an impudent expression on his face.
"Well, Silk?"
"I'm sure you can see by my position, old friend," the prince apologized to Belgarath, with a great show of regret. "If I try to keep secrets, she'll only force things out of me. Unpleasantly, I imagine." Belgarath looked at him with a stony face, then snorted in disgust. "Oh, it's not that I want to say anything, you realize?" Belgarath turned away. "I knew that you'd understand."
"The story, Silk,"
Barak insisted impatiently. "Oh, it's really very simple," Keldar told him.
"But you're going to complicate it, right?"
"Just tell us what happened, Silk."
The Drasnian sat up on his bench.
"It's not really much of a story. We located Zidar's trail and followed it down into Nyssa about 3 weeks ago. We had a few encounters with some Nyssan border guards. Oh, nothing very serious. Anyway, the trail of the orb turned east, almost as soon as it crossed the border. That was a surprise. Zedar had been headed for Nyssa with so much single-mindedness that we had both assumed that he'd made some kind of arrangement with Salmisra. Maybe that's what he wanted everyone to think. Oh, he's very clever. And Salmisra's notorious for involving herself in things that don't really concern her." "I have attended to that,"
Lady Polgara said somewhat grimly.
"What happened?"
Belgarath asked her.
"I will tell you about it later, Father. Go on, Silk."
Silk shrugged.
"There isn't a great deal more to it. We followed Zidar's trail into one of those ruined cities up near the old Marag border. Belgarath had a visitor there. At least, he said he did. I didn't see anyone. At any rate, he told me that something had happened to change our plans, and that we were going to have to turn around and come downriver to Stithis Tor to rejoin all of you. He didn't have time to explain much more, because the jungles were suddenly alive with Murgos, either looking for us or for Zedar. We never found out which. Since then, we've been dodging Murgos, and Naysons both, traveling at night, hiding, that sort of thing. We sent a messenger once. Did he ever get through?" "The day before yesterday," Polgara replied. "He had a fever, though, and it took a while to get your message from him."
Keldar nodded. "Anyway, there were Grolems with the Murgos, and they were trying to find us with their minds. Belgarath was doing something to keep them from locating us that way. Whatever it was, must have taken a great deal of concentration, because he wasn't paying too much attention to where he was going. Early this morning, we were leading the horses through a patch of swamp. Belgarath was sort of stumbling along with his mind on other things, and that was when the tree fell on him."
"I might have guessed," Polgara said. "Did someone make it fall?"
"Oh, I don't think so. It might have been an old debt fall, but I rather doubt it. It was rotten at the center. I tried to warn him, but he walked right under it."
"All right," Belgarath said.
"I did try to warn you."
"Don't belabor it, Silk."
"I wouldn't want them to think that I didn't try to warn you," Silk protested. Polgara shook her head and spoke with a profound note of disappointment in her voice.
"Father."
"Just let it lie, Polgara."
"I dug him out from under the tree and patched him up as best as I could. Then I stole that little boat, and we started downriver. We were doing fine, until all of this dust started falling."
What did you do with the horses?
Hedar asked. Zenedra was a little afraid of this tall, silent Algar lord. She looked at his shaved head, his black leather clothing, and his flowing black scalp lock. He never seemed to smile, and the expression on his hawk-like face at even the mention of the word Murgo was as bleak as stone. The only thing that even slightly humanized him was his overwhelming concern for horses. They're all right, Silk assured him. I left them picketed, where the Nyssons won't find them. They will be fine where they are until we can pick them up. You said when you came aboard that Tuchek has the orb now, Bolgara said to Belgareth. How did that happen?
The old man shrugged.
Altira didn't go into any of the details. All he told me was that Tuchek was waiting when Zadar crossed the border into Khazar Mogos. Zadar managed to escape, but he had to leave the orb behind.
Did you speak with Beltira?
With his mind, Belgareth answered.
Did he say why the Master wants us to go to the Vale?
No. It probably never occurred to him to ask. You know how Beltira is.
It's going to take months, Father,
Bolgara objected with a worried frown. It is 250 leagues to the Vale.
Aldur wants us to go there. I'm not going to start disobeying him after all of these years.
And in the meantime, Tuchik's got the orb at Rakhtul.
It's not going to do him any good, Paul. Torak himself could not make the orb submit to him, and he tried for over 2,000 years. I know where Rakhtul is. Tuchik cannot hide it from me. He will be there with the orb when I decide to go and take it away from him. I know how to deal with that magician.
He said the word magician with a note of profound contempt in his voice.
What's Zadar going to be doing all of that time?
Zadar has got problems of his own. Beltira says that he's moved Torak from the place where he had him hidden. I think we can depend on him to keep Torek's body as far away from Rakhtul as possible. Actually, things have worked out rather well. I was getting a little tired of chasing Zadar anyway.
Zenedra found all of this a bit confusing. Why were they all so caught up in the movements of a strangely named pair of Angarak sorcerers and this mysterious jewel which everyone seemed to covet? To her, one jewel was much the same as another. Her childhood had been surrounded by such opulence that she had long since ceased to attach much importance to ornaments. At the moment, her only adornment consisted of a pair of tiny gold earrings shaped like little acorns, and her fondness for them arose not so much from the fact that they were gold, but rather from the tinkling sound the cunningly contrived clappers inside them made when she moved her head. All of this sounded like one of the Aelorn myths she had heard from a storyteller in her father's court years before. There had been a magic jewel in that, she remembered. It was stolen by the god of the Angoraks, Torak, and rescued by a sorcerer and some Aelorn kings who put it on the pommel of a sword kept in the throne room at Reva. It was somehow supposed to protect the West from some terrible disaster that would happen if it were lost. Curious. The name of the sorcerer in that legend was Belgarath, the same as that of this old man. Oh, but that would make him thousands of years old, which, of course, was ridiculous. He must have been named after the ancient mythic hero, unless he had assumed the name to impress people. Once again, her eyes wandered to Garion's face. The boy sat quietly in one corner of the cabin, his eyes grave, his expression serious. She thought, perhaps, that it was his seriousness that so piqued her curiosity, and kept drawing her eyes to him. Other boys she had known, nobles and the sons of nobles, had tried to be charming and witty. But Garion never tried to joke or to say clever things to try to amuse her. She was not entirely certain how to take that. Was he such a lump that he did not know how he was supposed to behave? Or perhaps he knew, but didn't care enough to make the effort. He might at least try, even if only occasionally. How could she possibly deal with him if he was going to refuse flatly to make a fool of himself for her benefit? She reminded herself sharply that she was angry with him. He had said that the Queen Salmisra had been the most beautiful woman he had ever seen, and it was far, far too early to forgive him for such an outrageous statement. She was definitely going to have to make him suffer extensively for that insulting lapse. Her fingers toyed absently with one of the curls cascading down the side of her face, her eyes boring into Geryon's face. The following morning, the ashfall that was the result of a massive volcanic eruption somewhere in Cthulhu Murgos had diminished sufficiently to make the deck of the ship habitable again. The jungle along the riverbank was still partially obscured in the dusty haze, but the air was clear enough to breathe, and Senedra escaped from the sweltering cabin below deck with relief. Geryon was sitting in the sheltered spot near the bow of the ship, where he usually sat, and he was deep in conversation with Belgarath. Senedra noted with a certain detachment that he had neglected to comb his hair that morning. She resisted her immediate impulse to go fetch a comb and brush to rectify the situation. She drifted instead, with artful dissimulation, to a place along the rail where, without seeming to, she could conveniently eavesdrop.
"It's always been there," Geryon was saying to his grandfather. "It used to just talk to me. Tell me when I was being childish or stupid, that sort of thing. It seemed to be off in one corner of my mind all by itself."
Belgarath nodded, scratching absently at his beard with his good hand.
"It seems to be completely separate from you," he observed. "Has this voice in your head ever actually done anything? Besides talk to you, I mean."
Geryon's face grew thoughtful.
"I don't think so. It tells me how to do things, but I think that I'm the one who has to do them. When we were at Salmisra's palace, I think it took me out of my body to go look for Aunt Paul."
He frowned.
"No," he corrected. "When I stop and think about it, it told me how to do it, but I was the one who actually did. Once we were out, I could feel it beside me. It's the first time we've ever been separate. I couldn't actually see it, though. It did take over for a few minutes, I think. It talked to Salmisra to smooth things over, and to hide what we had been doing."
"You have been busy since Silk and I left, haven't you?"
Geryon nodded glumly.
"Most of it was pretty awful. I burned Ashrak. Did you know that?"
"Your aunt told me about it."
"He slapped her in the face,"
Geryon told him.
"I was going to go after him with my knife for that, but the voice told me to do it a different way. I hit him with my hand and said, 'Burn.' That's all. Just burn. And he caught fire. I was going to put it out until Aunt Paul told me he was the one who killed my mother and father. Then I made the fire hotter. He begged me to put it out, but I didn't do it."
He shuddered.
"I tried to warn you about that,"
Belgarath reminded him gently.
"I told you that you weren't going to like it very much after it was over."
Geryon sighed.
"I should have listened. Aunt Paul says that once you've used this,"
he floundered, looking for a word.
"Power?"
Belgarath suggested.
"All right,"
Geryon assented.
"She says that once you have used it, you never forget how. And you'll keep doing it again and again. I wish I had used my knife instead. Then this thing in me never would have gotten loose."
"You're wrong, you know,"
Belgarath told him quite calmly.
"You have been bursting at the seams with it for several months now. You've used it without knowing it at least half a dozen times that I know about."
Geryon stared at him incredulously.
"Remember that crazy monk just after we crossed into Tonedra? When you touched him,
You made so much noise that I thought for a moment you had killed him.
You said Aunt Paul did that.
I lied, the old man admitted casually. I do that fairly often. The whole point, though, is that you have always had this ability. It was bound to come out sooner or later. I wouldn't feel too unhappy about what you did to Khamdar. It was a little exotic, perhaps, not exactly the way I might have done it, but there was a certain justice to it, after all.
It's always going to be there, then?
Always. That's the way it is, I'm afraid.
The Princess Zenedra felt rather smug about that. Belgareth had just confirmed something she herself had told Geryon. If the boy would just stop being so stubborn, his aunt and his grandfather, and of course she herself, all of whom knew much better than he what was right and proper and good for him, could shape his life to their satisfaction with little or no difficulty.
"Let's get back to this other voice of yours," Belgareth suggested. "I need to know more about it. I don't want you carrying an enemy around in your mind."
"It's not an enemy," Geryon insisted. "It's on our side."
"It might seem that way," Belgareth observed. "But things are not always what they seem. I'd be a lot more comfortable if I knew just exactly what it is. I don't like surprises."
The Princess Zenedra, however, was already lost in thought. Dimly, at the back of her devious and complex little mind, an idea was beginning to take shape. An idea with very interesting possibilities. Chapter 2. The trip up to the rapids of the River of the Serpent took the better part of a week. Although it was still swelteringly hot, they had all by now grown at least partially accustomed to the climate. Princess Zenedra spent most of her time sitting on the deck with Bolgara, pointedly ignoring Geryon. She did, however, glance frequently his way to see if she could detect any signs of suffering. Since her life was entirely in the hands of these people, Zenedra felt keenly the necessity for winning them over. Belgareth would be no problem. A few winsome little girl smiles, a bit of eyelash fluttering, and a spontaneous-seeming kiss or two would wrap him neatly around one of her fingers. That particular campaign could be conducted at any time she felt it convenient. But Palgara was a different matter. For one thing, Zenedra was awed by the lady's spectacular beauty. Palgara was flawless. Even the white lock in the midnight of her hair was not so much a defect as it was a sort of accent, a personal trademark. Most disconcerting to the princess were Polgara's eyes. Depending on her mood, they ranged in color from gray to a deep, deep blue, and they saw through everything. No dissimulation was possible in the face of that calm, steady gaze. Each time the princess looked into those eyes, she seemed to hear the clink of chains. She definitely had to get on Polgara's good side.
"Lady Polgara,"
the princess said one morning as they sat together on the deck, while the steaming gray-green jungle slid by on either bank, and the sweating sailors labored at their oars.
"Yes, dear."
Polgara looked up from the button she was sewing on one of Geryon's tunics. She wore a pale blue dress, open at the throat in the heat.
"What is sorcery? I was always told that such things didn't exist."
It seemed like a good place to start the discussion. Polgara smiled at her.
"Tolnedran education tends to be a bit one-sided." "Is it a trick of some kind?"
Zenedra persisted.
"I mean, is it like showing people something with one hand while you're taking something away with the other?"
She toyed with the laces on her sandals.
"No, dear. It's nothing at all like that." "Exactly how much can one do with it?" "We have never explored that particular boundary,"
Polgara replied, her needle still busy.
"When something has to be done, we do it. We do not bother worrying about whether we can or cannot. Different people are better at different things, though. It's somewhat on the order of some men being better at carpentry, while others specialize in stonemasonry.
Geryon is a sorcerer, isn't he? How much can he do?
Now, why had she asked that?
I was wondering where this was leading, Fogara said, giving the tiny girl a penetrating look. Tenedra blushed slightly.
Don't chew on your hair, dear. You'll split the ends.
Tenedra quickly removed the curl from between her teeth.
We are not sure what Geryon can do yet,
Fogara continued.
It is probably much too early to tell. He seems to have talent. He certainly makes enough noise whenever he does something, and that is a fair indication of his potential.
He will probably be a very powerful sorcerer, then?
A faint smile touched Palgara's lips.
Probably so. Always assuming that he learns to control himself?
Well,
Tenedra declared,
we would just have to teach him to control himself, then, won't we?
Palgara looked at her for a moment, and then she began to laugh. Tenedra felt a bit sheepish, but she also laughed. Geryon, who was standing not far away, turned to look at them.
What's so funny? Nothing you would understand, dear,
Palgara told him. He looked offended and moved away, his back stiff and his face set. Tenedra and Palgara laughed again. When Captain Greldick's ship finally reached the point where rocks and swiftly tumbling water made it impossible to go any farther, they moored her to a large tree on the north bank, and the party prepared to go ashore. Barak stood sweating in his mail shirt beside his friend Greldick, watching Hetar oversee the unloading of the horses.
"If you happen to see my wife, give her my greetings," the red-bearded man said.
Greldick nodded. "They'll probably be near Trelheim sometime during the winter."
"I don't know that you need to tell her that I know about her pregnancy. She'll probably want to surprise me with my son when I get home. I wouldn't want to spoil that for her."
Greldick looked a little surprised.
"I thought you enjoyed spoiling things for her, Barak."
"Maybe it is time that Merl and I made peace with each other. This little war of ours was amusing when we were younger, but it might not be a bad idea to put it aside now, for the sake of the children, if nothing else."
Dolgareth came up on deck and joined the two bearded Cheriks.
"Go to Val'Aron," he told Captain Greldick. "Tell Anheg where we are and what we are doing. Have him get word to the others. Tell them that I absolutely forbid their going to war with the Angoraks just now. Tuchuk has the Orb of Rakdul, and if there's a war, Thorolgos will seal the borders of Thrall Murgos. Things are going to be difficult enough for us without that to contend with."
"I'll tell him," Greldick replied doubtfully. "I don't think he'll like it much, though."
"He doesn't have to like it," Belgareth said bluntly. "He just has to do it."
Tenedra, standing not far away, felt a little startled when she heard the shabby-looking old man issuing peremptory commands. How could he speak so to sovereign kings? And what if Geryon, as a sorcerer, should someday have a similar authority? She turned and gazed at the young man who was helping Jernic the smith, calm and excited horse. He didn't look authoritative. She pursed her lips. A robe of some kind might help. Maybe some sort of a book of magic in his hands. And perhaps just the hint of a beard. She narrowed her eyes, imagining him so robed, booked, and bearded. Geryon, obviously feeling her eyes on him, looked quickly in her direction, his expression questioning. He was so ordinary. The image of this plain, unassuming boy and the finery she had concocted for him in her mind was suddenly ludicrous. Without meaning to, she laughed. Geryon flushed and stiffly turned his back on her. Since the rapids of the River of the Serpent effectively blocked all further navigation upriver, the trail leading up into the hills was quite broad, indicating that most travelers struck out overland at this point. As they rode up out of the valley in the mid-morning sunlight, they passed rather quickly out of the tangled jungle growth lining the river and moved into a hardwood forest that was much more to Senedra's liking. At the crest of the first rise, they even encountered a breeze that seemed to brush away the sweltering heat and the stink of Nyssa's festering swamps. Senedra's spirits lifted immediately. She considered the company of Prince Keldar, but he was dozing in his saddle, and Senedra was just a bit afraid of the sharp-nosed Drasnian. She recognized immediately that the cynical, wise little man could probably read her like a book, and she did not really care for that idea. Instead, she rode forward along the column to ride with Baron Mandoralan, who led the way as was his custom. Her move was prompted in part by the desire to get as far away as possible from the steaming river, but there was more to it than that. It occurred to her that this might be an excellent opportunity to question this Arendish nobleman about a matter that interested her.
"Your Highness," the armored knight said respectfully as she pulled her horse in beside his huge charger, "dost thou think it prudent to place thyself in the vanguard thus?"
"Who would be so foolish as to attack the bravest knight in the world?"
she asked, with artful innocence. The baron's expression grew melancholy, and he sighed.
"And why so great a sigh, Sir Knight?"
"It is of no moment, Your Highness."
They rode along in silence through the dappled shade where insects hummed and darted, and small scurrying things skittered and rustled in the bushes at the side of the trail.
"Tell me,"
the princess said finally,
"have you known Belgarath for long?"
"All my life, Your Highness."
"Is he highly regarded in Arendia?"
"Highly regarded? Holy Belgarath is the paramount man in the world. Surely thou knowest that, princess."
"I am Ton Nedran, Baron Mandoralan,"
she pointed out.
"Our familiarity with sorcerers is limited. Would an Arend describe Belgarath as a man of noble birth?"
Mandoralan laughed. "Your Highness, holy Belgarath's birth is so far lost in the dim reaches of antiquity that thy question has no meaning."
Senedra frowned. She did not particularly like being laughed at.
"Is he or is he not a nobleman?"
"He is Belgarath,"
Mandoralan replied, as if that explained everything.
"There are hundreds of barons, earls by the score, lords without number. But there is only one Belgarath. All men give way to him."
She beamed at him.
"And what about Lady Belgara?"
Mandoralan blinked, and Senedra saw that she was going too fast for him.
"The Lady Belgara is revered above all women." He said it with a puzzled note. "Highness, could I but know the direction of your inquiry, I might provide thee with a more satisfactory response."
She laughed.
"My dear Baron, it is nothing important or serious, just curiosity, and a way to pass the time as we ride."
Durnick, the smith, came forward at a trot just then, his sorrel horse's hoofbeats thudding on the packed earth of the trail.
"Mistress Bull wants you to wait for a bit."
"Is anything wrong?"
"No, it's just that there's a bush not far from the trail that she recognized. Wants to harvest some of the leaves. I think they have certain medicinal uses. She says it's very rare and only found in this part of Nyssa."
The smith's plain, honest face was respectful, as it always was when he spoke of Palgra. Tenedra had certain private suspicions about Durnick's feelings, but she kept them to herself.
"Oh," he went on, "she said to warn you about the bush. Might be others round. It's about a foot tall, has a very shiny green leaf and a little purple flower. Deadly poisonous, even to touch." "We will not stray from the trail, good man," Mandoralan assured him, "but we'll abide here against the lady's permission to proceed."
Durnick nodded and rode on back down the trail. Senedra and Mandoralan pulled their horses into the shade of a broad tree and sat waiting.
"How do the Arends regard Geryon?"
Senedra asked suddenly.
"Geryon, he is a good lad," Mandoralan replied, somewhat confused.
"Oh, but hardly noble,"
she prompted him.
Highness, Mandarellan told her delicately, thine education, I fear, has led thee astray. Garion is of the line of Belgarath and Polgara. Though he hath no rank such as thou and I both have, his blood is of the noblest in the world. I would give precedence to him without question, should he ask it of me, which he would not, being a modest lad. During our sojourn at the court of King Corodulan at Vomimbre, a young countess pursued him most fervently, thinking to gain status and prestige by marriage to him.
Really?
Senedra asked, with a hard little edge coming into her voice.
She sought betrothal, and trapped him often with blatant invitation to dalliance and sweet conversation.
A beautiful countess?
Oh, one of the great beauties of the kingdom.
I see.
Senedra's voice was now like ice.
Have I given offense, Highness?
It's not important.
Mandarellan sighed again.
What is it now?
I perceive that my faults are many.
I thought you were supposed to be the perfect man.
She regretted that instantly.
Nay, Highness, I am marred beyond thy conception.
Oh, a bit undiplomatic, perhaps, but that's no great in an errand.
But cowardice is, Highness.
She laughed at the notion.
Cowardice? You?
I have found that fault in myself, he admitted.
Don't be ridiculous. If anything, your fault lies in the other direction.
It is difficult to believe, I know. But I assure thee with great shame that I have felt the grip of fear upon my heart.
Senedra was baffled by the knight's mournful confession. She was struggling to find some proper reply when a great crashing rush burst out of the undergrowth a few yards away. With a sudden start of panic, her horse wheeled and bolted. She caught only the briefest glimpse of something large and tawny leaping out of the bushes at her. Large, tawny, and with a great gaping mouth. She tried desperately to cling to her saddle with one hand and to control her terrified horse with the other, but its frantic flight took him under a low branch, and she was swept off of its back to land unceremoniously in the middle of the trail. She rolled to her hands and knees, and then froze as she faced the beast that had so clumsily burst forth from concealment. She saw at once that the lion was not very old. She noted that, though his body was fully developed, he had only a half-grown mane. Clearly, he was an adolescent, unskilled at hunting. He roared with frustration as he watched the fleeing horse disappear back down the trail and his tail lashed. The princess felt a momentary touch of amusement. He was so young, so awkward. Then her amusement was replaced by irritation with this clumsy young beast who had caused her humiliating unhorsing. She rose to her feet, brushed off her knees, and looked at him sternly.
"Shoo!"
she said, with an insistent flip of her hand. She was, after all, a princess, and he was only a lion, a very young and foolish lion. The yellow eyes fell on her then and narrowed slightly. The lashing tail grew suddenly quite still. The young lion's eyes widened with a sort of dreadful intensity, and he crouched, his belly going low to the ground. His upper lip lifted to reveal his very long white teeth. He took one slow step toward her, his great paw touching down softly.
"Don't you dare,"
she told him indignantly.
"Remain quite still, Highness,"
Mandarellan warned her in a deathly quiet voice. From the corner of her eye, she saw him slide out of the saddle. The lion's eyes flickered toward him with annoyance. Carefully, one step at a time, Mandarellan crossed the intervening space until he had placed his armored body between the lion and the princess. The lion watched him warily, not seeming to realize what he was doing until it was too late. Then, cheated of another meal, the cat's eyes went flat with rage. Mandarellan drew his sword very carefully, Then, to Senedra's amazement, he passed it back, hilt first, to her.
"So that thou shalt have means of defending thyself, should I fail to withstand him," the knight explained.
Doubtfully, Senedra took hold of the huge hilt with both hands. When Mandarallan released his grip on the blade, however, the point dropped immediately to the ground. Try though she might, Senedra could not even lift the huge sword. Snarling, the lion crouched even lower. His tail lashed furiously for a moment, then stiffened out behind him.
"Mandarallan, look out!"
Senedra screamed, still struggling with the sword. The lion leaped. Mandarallan flung his steel-cased arms wide and stepped forward to meet the cat's charge. They came together with a resounding crash, and Mandarallan locked his arms around the beast's body. The lion wrapped his huge paws around Mandarallan's shoulders, and his claws screeched deafeningly as they raked the steel of the knight's armor. His teeth grated and ground as he gnawed and bit at Mandarallan's helmeted head. Mandarallan tightened his deadly embrace. Senedra scrambled out of the way, dragging the sword behind her, and stared, wide-eyed with fright, at the dreadful struggle. The lion's clawing became more desperate and great. Deep scratches appeared on Mandarallan's armor as the membrane's arms tightened inexorably. The roars became yowls of pain, and the lion struggled now not to fight or kill, but to escape. He wriggled and thrashed and tried to bite. His hind paws came up to rake furiously on Mandarallan's armored trunk. His yowls grew more shrill, more filled with panic. With a superhuman effort, Mandarallan jerked his arms together. Senedra heard the cracking of bones with a sickening clarity, and an enormous fountain of blood erupted from the cat's mouth. The young lion's body quivered, and his head dropped. Mandarallan unclenched his locked hands, and the dead beast slid limply from his grasp to the ground at his feet. Stunned, the princess stared at the stupendous man in blood-smeared, clawed armor standing before her. She had just witnessed the impossible. Mandarallan had killed a lion with no weapon but his mighty arms. All for her. Without knowing why, she found herself crowing with delight.
"Mandarallan!"
She fair sang his name.
"You are my knight!"
Still panting from his efforts, Mandarallan pushed up his visor. His blue eyes were wide, as if her words had struck him with a stunning impact. Then he sank to his knees before her.
"Your Highness," he said in a choked voice, "I have pledged to thee, here upon the body of this beast, to be thy true and faithful knight for so long as I have breath."
Deep inside her, Senedra felt a profound sort of click, the sound of two things, fated from time's beginning to come together, finally meeting. Something, she did not know exactly what, but something very important had happened there in that sun-dappled glade. And then Barak, huge and imposing, came galloping up the trail with Hetar at his side, and the others not far behind.
"What happened?"
the big Cherek demanded, swinging down from his horse. Senedra waited until they had all reined in to make her announcement.
"The lion there attacked me," she said,
trying to make it sound like an everyday occurrence.
"Mandarallan killed him with his bare hands."
"I was in fact wearing these, Highness,"
the still kneeling knight reminded her, holding up his gauntleted fists.
"He was the bravest thing I have ever seen in my life,"
Senedra swept on.
"Why are you down on your knees?" Barak asked Mandarallan. "Are you hurt?"
"I have just made Sir Mandarallan my very own knight,"
Senedra declared.
"And as is quite proper, he knelt to receive that honor from my hands."
From the corner of her eye, she saw Geryon in the act of sliding down from his horse. He was scowling like a thundercloud. Silently, Senedra exulted. Leaning forward, then, she placed a sisterly kiss on Mandarallan's brow.
"Rise, Sir Knight,"
she commanded, and Mandarallan creaked to his feet. Senedra was enormously pleased with herself. The remainder of the day passed without incident. They crossed a low range of hills and came down into a little valley as the sun settled slowly into a cloud bank off to the west. The valley was watered by a small stream, sparkling and cold, and they stopped there to set up their night's encampment. Mandaralan, in his new role as night protector, was suitably attentive, and Zenedra accepted his service graciously, casting occasional covert glances at Geryon to be certain that he was noticing everything. Somewhat later, when Mandaralan had gone to see to his horse and Geryon had stomped off to sulk, she sat demurely on a moss-covered log, congratulating herself on the day's accomplishments.
"Aye, you're playing a cruel game, princess," Durnick told her bluntly from the spot a few feet away where he was building a fire.
Zenedra was startled. So far as she could remember, Durnick had never spoken directly to her since she had joined the party. The smith was obviously uncomfortable in the presence of royalty, and indeed seemed actually to avoid her. Now, however, he looked straight into her face, and his tone was reproving.
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"Oh, I think you do."
His plain, honest face was serious, and his gaze was steady. Zenedra lowered her eyes and flushed slowly.
"I've seen village girls play this same game. Nothing good ever comes of it."
"I'm not trying to hurt anybody, Durnick. There isn't really anything of that sort between Mandaralan and me. We both know that."
"Ah, but Geryon doesn't."
Zenedra was amazed.
"Geryon?
Isn't that what it's all about, then?"
"Well, of course not,"
she objected indignantly. Durnick's look was profoundly skeptical.
"Such a thing never entered my mind,"
Zenedra rushed on.
It's absolutely absurd."
"Really?"
Zenedra's bold front collapsed.
"He is so stubborn," she complained. "He just won't do anything the way he's supposed to."
"He's an honest boy. Whatever else he is or might become, he's still the plain, simple boy he was at Faldor's farm. He doesn't know the rules of the gentry. He won't lie to you or flatter you, or say things he doesn't really feel. I think something very important's going to happen to him before very long. Oh, I don't know what. But I do know it's going to take all his strength and courage. Don't weaken him with all of this childishness."
"Oh, Durnick,"
she said with a great sigh.
"What am I going to do?"
"Be honest. Say only what's on your heart. Now don't say one thing and mean another. That won't work with him."
"I know. That's what makes it all so difficult. He was raised one way and I was raised another. We're never going to get along."
She sighed again. Durnick smiled. A gentle, almost whimsical smile.
"Oh, nah. It's not all that bad, princess. You'll fight a great deal at first. You're almost as stubborn as he is, you know. You were born in different parts of the world, but you're not really all that different inside. Oh, you shout at each other and shake your fingers in each other's faces, but in time that'll pass. You won't even remember what you were shouting about. Some of the best marriages I know of started that way."
"Marriage?"
"Oh, that's what you've got in mind, isn't it?"
She stared at him incredulously. Then she suddenly laughed.
"Dear, dear Durnick, you don't understand at all, do you?"
"Oh, I understand what I see. And what I see is a young girl doing everything she possibly can to catch a young man."
Zenedra sighed.
"That is completely out of the question, you know. Even if I felt that way, which of course I don't."
"Naturally not."
He looked slightly amused.